Hello, my lovelies. Welcome to the Sacred AF podcast. I'm your host, Kristen Lena. Now let's have some radically honest conversations about being a rule-breaking, system-disrupting, sacred-as-fuck woman.
Hello, lovelies. All right, so today's guest on the Sacred AF podcast is Soraya Shimali. She is the author of Rage Becomes Her, The Power of Women's Anger, which was recognized as a best book of 2018 by the Washington Post, Fast Company, Psychology Today, and NPR, and it's been translated into multiple languages. She's also an activist. She spearheaded successful campaigns challenging corporations to address online hate and harassment, restrictive content moderation and censorship, and institutional biases that affect free speech. She considers herself a feminist, and in 2019, she was awarded the Feminist Press Feminist Power Award. Soraya and I, you know, I picked up her book last year when the pandemic hit. And soon after the pandemic hit, the Black Lives Matter became a priority for me personally in my life. I woke up to the effects of systemic racism in the US and my implicit involvement just based on white privilege. I really dove into that. And I was so angry. I was just so angry. And so I ended up Googling Women's Rage, and her book was at the top of the list. And we talk about so many cool things on this episode. How to and why to, as women, why we should embrace our anger rather than continue to do what we've been doing as a collective, as a society, systemically, which is to nice it up, which is to soften it, which is to express sadness or disappointment as opposed to anger, fury, or rage, and how systemically we're conditioned to be kind, not angry. And so as I dove into my own anger over the past year and a half, I really got a sense of what it looks like to repress it, how that manifests physically in my own body and in my relationships as a mom, as a wife, as a woman who still lives in this society. So we had an amazing conversation. We went all kinds of places, and she is just remarkable in the work that she does. So I would love for you to sit back and take in all of what becomes you about rage as you listen to this episode with Soraya Shimali. Have fun. Soraya, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for being here. This gets to be a really fun conversation about women's anger. And the reason why I've been following you for at least the last 6 months, picked up your book, was like, holy crap, yes. Thank you for putting words on paper about how I would honestly say always felt, knowing full well that the anger that I felt inside me was here for something. It wasn't meant for me to push it aside. It wasn't meant for me to deny it. And I got to this point where I was like, well, I'm pretty comfortable with anger, and I get to figure out an empowered way for me to channel it and catalyze it. And so I Googled women's rage or women in rage, because it wasn't anger that I was experiencing, it was rage. And your book was at the top of the list. And so tell me, let's talk a little bit about what was the catalyst for this? What was the, I got to write this book? Was it just a culmination of years of work, or was it like, this gets to happen?
Well, I think it was several things. It was definitely the culmination of years of work. I'd been writing about social justice issues and women around the globe, whether it was politics or religion or media, education, child rearing. And so a lot of that work went into this book, because during the 2016 election, it was just really striking how differently anger in white men was treated than anger in white women, Black people, immigrants. It was just a completely different categorization of the expression of this emotion. So in the most blunt way, both Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders could leverage populist anger, and they could be angry themselves. So they could look angry, and that strengthened people's impression of their leadership. But for any woman did, and it was eventually just Hillary Clinton to do that, would have been suicide. And we saw that also on our streets. Women were protesting Donald Trump before he was elected, and then by the millions around the world the day of his inauguration. And that anger just wasn't treated like a citizenship entitlement. It was really treated like, honestly, even with millions and millions of women, almost like a pet project. Like even the year after, when millions and millions of women again to the streets, it didn't even make the front pages of most major media companies around the world. It was like, oh yeah, we did that last year. So anyway, I thought, let me take all of this work and also life experience, having had the same, these types of experiences, and use anger as a way to look at what's happening here to our free speech and our safety and our rights and our health and well-being.
Say more about health and well-being, because honestly, that's one of the things that also led me to dive into this topic of my own rage, my own fury, my own anger, and how it manifested in my body physically. That was an area I went to as well. What do you mean by that?
I think it's the ways in which we don't think about how our emotions affect our physical bodies. And we are immersed in the Western tradition of thinking that the mind and the body are split. And it's a very Cartesian, dualistic way of understanding the world that kind of flies in the face of our experience of living, right? And yet we hold these beliefs. And I think anger is an example of the ways in which the mind and body are really one.
That's amazing. I want to hear more. Please tell me more.
Well, throughout the book has a very linear progression, basically through infancy through old age. And it looks also in a different dimension at the personal, interpersonal, professional, and political, right? And so one of the intersections between those things, there are just examples of how anger becomes material in our bodies and in our systems. And so in our bodies, we know that there are lots of illnesses that are often attributed to, they're sort of categorized as women's illnesses, the way hysteria was in the large part of our history. But those illnesses all share the quality of suppressed, repressed, and diverted anger. And the control of that emotion in those not productive, not healthy ways exacerbates pain, chronic illness, recovery from illness and surgery. I mean, there are all kinds of correlations and in some cases causality that I write about in terms of how people make sense of their experience of anger. Can they identify it? Can they name it, label it, listen to what it's telling them? And then can they actually do anything about it? Can they hold the people around them responsible and accountable for mutual care?
I want to talk about this, the story you open with your mom and the plates. And I want to talk about that and how it's such a brilliant illustration of how women's anger up until probably recently has occurred, has expressed itself, being nice, sort of feminine, keeping it all together sort of ways.
Yeah, I mean, I think my mom grew up, she actually converted from Anglicanism to Catholicism, but she was sort of, she went to a convent school. She was very typical firstborn good girl in that ladylike mold where to be angry is to, frankly, if you're religious, to be sinful, right? Like it's a sin. And it's also, if you're a woman, selfish and cruel. And that's a very absolute categorical way of thinking. But in fact, it is implicit in so many of our stereotypes about gender and anger. All of us learn to associate anger with men and masculinity when we're very, very young. And we learn to detach it from women and femininity and girl. And girls are punished if they show anger. They don't even have to show anger. They can be assertive. It's not even anger. They can be aggressive, also not anger. But that behavior is policed and it's punished. So girls are encouraged to put others first, to speak in their nice voices, to lower, change their tone, to not be selfish, to not interrupt. I mean, there are all of these sort of politeness norms. And honestly, mainly that's white girls, right? Because if you're a black girl, you don't even get the benefit of any of that. like if you're in school, you're just much more likely to be harshly disciplined for being what in a young boy, a young white boy, would be categorized as rambunctious. And so those stereotypes start really early. And the flip side of that is people attribute sadness to girls and women instead of anger. And with boys, they deny them the right to express sadness because it's a weak, feminizing trait. So it doesn't really serve anybody very well. But there is a difference because sadness is a retreat emotion. You're supposed to ruminate and turn in on yourself. And sad people are more empathetic, but angry people believe they have the right to a different future, to make demands on the world, to be able to influence the world around them. And that's a very different orientation.
Wow. When you say it like that, immediately my brain wants to go good, bad, right, wrong, right? Because this is part of the conditioning. Sad is okay for women to feel, not okay for boys to feel. Rage and anger, not okay for girls, completely acceptable for white boys and later men. For you, I know you talk in the book about an experience, one of your daughters building these blocks and every day going to school and building this structure and this, it was a castle or something, and the boy coming over. So what is it, if you could share some of the things that happened either to you as a young child or to you as a parent raising girls, I'm a parent raising girls, that you could see your own conditioning, you could see the cultural conditioning that had you go, holy smokes.
Yeah, sure. There's so many examples that I can think of, right, where we learn very young as girls that we're expected to nurture and maintain relationships. And anything that does reminds that is bad. It makes you a bad woman or a bad girl, right? And so any kind of emotion that you might have that warns you the way anger does, anger is a signal emotion that warns you of threat to your body or your dignity. We have anger for a reason. And yet we're told to ignore it and to ignore what that anger is telling us. And so in the case of my daughter, it was just very clear over and over again that she would build this thing and this boy would rip it down. And his parents were always there and they never did anything until afterwards. They were filled with platitudes afterwards about how boys will be boys and how they can't control themselves and was such a beautiful, sparkly thing. How could he resist? And honestly, I shouldn't joke about this because it's quite serious, but I remember thinking to myself, I can't explain to them that they're growing a rapist. These kids are four. That is exactly what is happening here. He is being allowed to find the terms of the relationship, to control the environment, and that she's supposed to adapt to that, adjust to that, be pleasant and polite about doing that, and frankly, be implicated in his emotional development, where she has no responsibility for being implicated in his emotional development. And he's infringing on her labor and her space and all of these other things. But I didn't do any of that in the moment. I tried to teach her to sort of be a good citizen. And so she tried using her words and that didn't work. And then she tried body blocking him and that didn't work. Then we talked to the teacher and she can build it over there, which is absurd, right? There was never a point at which this boy was held accountable. And I think that's pretty typical. And I did something women often do, which is to preemptively stop my own anger so that I wouldn't be blamed for being disagreeable or disruptive. And if she had lost, my daughter had really lost her temper, I'm pretty sure there would have been an equivalence made between her bad behavior and his. And I'm like, there's no equivalence here. That, like, she's acting in self-defense in the absence of us really helping her or giving her feelings legitimacy. And I thought it was interesting because I was on book tour. So years after, I was on an airplane in Australia and we'd been waiting for 3 or 4 hours for this flight. We finally get on at 10 o'clock at night. It'd been a very long day. When I got in the plane, I pushed my seat back. I was just so happy to be sitting and not carrying bags. And two flight attendants came over after we up in the air and they said, would you mind moving your seat forward? And I said, well, sure, but why? I mean, we just took off and we have an hour and a half left. And he said, well, the man behind you is very uncomfortable. And I said, oh, well, that's unfortunate. And then I didn't say anything else. And they said, well, it'd be really nice if you moved your seat forward. And I said, I'm afraid you have the wrong gal. I said, I appreciate that. But basically, if I move my seat forward, I'm going to be really uncomfortable. And I purchased this ticket, and this ticket includes the right to push my seat back. And it's sort of the contract all of us make when we get on this plane. And they said, well, you know, do you think you could just be nice and move your seat forward? And I said, no, I'm sorry. I said, but there are empty seats like right across the aisle. And they said, well, would you like to move to one? And I said, no, but he's welcome to move. I mean, literally across from him were three empty seats. And so I didn't move my seat, and I'm sure he was upset, and I must have sounded like a complete bitch. And so before the flight landed, these two came barreling down the aisle and very loudly announced that for his troubles, they were going to give him a flight credit. That's basically the adult version of what happened in that classroom, right? And I was like, this is amazing. It's 2019, and this is what's happening on this airplane right now. So I actually, the next night, I was making a speech, and I included this story because I was so incensed. But it was a good example. And someone came up to me after, and she said, you know, I work for Qantas. I'm on the executive board. I'd like permission to use your story because, in fact, we have a major problem on our airlines in that flight attendants perceive their job to be to make men comfortable. And I just said, no problem, go right ahead.
Wow.
Use it, no problem at all.
I was thinking about the questions that I wanted to ask you. And there was a part in the book you talked about some of these transgressions that you had experienced at the hands of boys at 9 and then someone else at 14 and with your boyfriend, all of these things. And from my perspective, they were pretty big transgressions. Where I think I struggle is in that moment that takes you off guard, where you're having an interaction with a couple of older white men who we had ordered food from their restaurant. I mean, it was like we had bags of stuff. There was a bunch of us. And they said, would you like us to help you out? I was like, oh my gosh, thank you so much. There's cups. So they're helping us out. And one of the men walks out and says to the other gentleman who's waiting inside, I'll be back in a minute. And the other gentleman said, is that all you need? So in that moment, of course, it's a chuck. And I'm like, oh. And then I'm like, of course. Because A, I'm caught off guard. It's so abrasively, blindsidingly horrible. I just don't even expect it. I'm just kidding, or I'm just making fun, or that whole vein. You talk a little bit about this kind of how it's shocking and we freeze. What could I have said when I was really shocked?
Honestly, well, this is the problem, right? Because it never ceases to be shocking when it happens. This is it. Like, I'm 54 and it still happens. And I'm still caught off guard. And this has literally been happening to me since I was 9. I know this, right? Men, I mean, you're saying transgressions. I think I'm going to say what some of these are because, in fact, they're not just jokes, right? These are people grabbing you, touching you, asking you for oral sex on the side of the street, threatening to rape you. I mean, this is not funny in any way, right? And honestly, in my experience, I've had police officers do it. I've had doctors do it. I've had TSA agents do it. People who have power and authority, this is what they don't seem to understand, right? And that's really disturbing on so many levels. And so I don't know. It's very hard. It's very hard to know what to do and to prepare. And I'm always in awe of the women I see, and especially young women, who in the moment are so filled with righteous indignation and rage. And the thing is, I remember that. I remember once a guy pulled my arm. I was 15 and he grabbed my arm and he stopped me in my tracks. And I didn't know what was going on. And I turned around to look at him. And he basically was like, I just wanted to get a good look at you. And he wouldn't let go of my arm. And I was so enraged that I punched him in the neck. And he let go of me because it hurt him. And I bolted. I ran. But I realized, and he ran after me and he was yelling at me. And I realized right after that was a really foolish thing I probably did, right? To punch this man who was bigger than I was and older than I was. And so I never did that again. The lesson I took from that was that you have to find other ways as opposed to escalating the risk of physical harm. But that's pretty much the way women have to operate in general, right? And that's a problem because, in fact, when we face threat like that, it's not just that we're socialized to smile. It's that we actually have physiological responses that are tend and befriend responses. People think of fight or flight, which is much more likely if you're a man in this situation. But if you're a woman and you're faced with someone who's got overwhelming strength, or has a weapon or a history of violence, you don't take the fight. You freeze sometimes, but sometimes you do smile because you want to safely withdraw. And the law doesn't recognize that little socio-neurological response. That's why during rape cases, people will often judge a woman because she didn't fight or because she froze or she doesn't really remember what happened in the moment of trauma. And the courts just haven't caught up with what we know about human neurology.
So those moments are, they're so tenuous. And I guess what you're saying is do what makes you feel the most safe in that moment.
Well, I think that's right. It is really jarring, though. It's really very disturbing. And a lot of women, I think, afterwards are filled with shame because they think, why didn't I say something? Or why didn't I do something? And in fact, it isn't just that we have this physical response. It is that we are actively taught not to defend ourselves, right? And to just let it go and to let it slide and not to say anything. I should say, like, I did have one case where, again, it was amazing. Airports are such interesting places. I was going through security and basically undressed, right? I'd take off my jacket and my boots. And so I was left in a pair of leggings and a black t-shirt, black leggings, black t-shirt, no shoes. Like, I took everything off to go through the security. And there was the gate where you sort of walk through the scanner. And on the other end was a TSA person, a guy. And so before I walked through, he said, hold on a minute, please. Can you step back? And someone had just gone through, so I stepped back and he looks me up and down and then he says, okay, now you can come through. So I went through and he said, you know, black really suits your figure. And I was just like, what? Like, you had me step back so you could get a good look at my figure? And I was so filled with rage that he had just done this. And there were TSA agents everywhere, all men. There were 9 men. There were 6 men around me going through the line. And there were 3 TSA agents who were men. There was another woman in arm's length. And basically, I'm like, wait, you just did all of that for your own pleasure. And then you signaled it to all the other men by speaking very loudly about what you had just done. So I went through and there were 2 managers of the entire place. There were 2 women. One was maybe in her 30s and one was in her 20s. And I said, I'd like to file a report. And I told her what I'd done. And the first woman said, well, I need to go get him to hear his side of the story. And I said, that's not my business. I have a flight to catch. It's your job, not mine. I don't have to waste any more time here. I have told you what just happened. It's your responsibility. Women are not safe going through with that kind of interaction. And he has power over people going through that gate. She was so upset. You have to wait. And I said, no, I don't. You have to do your job, which is to make sure none of these men does this again. It was terrible.
This is, and again, call this a transgression. I think I'm being nice, right? This is my...
Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
It's just harassment.
Okay, let me ask you this question. What's the solution? And I mean like big, broad stroke, you know, transformational. We do things differently now. Remember when men were able to say things like, can you imagine that we get to look back? What's needed to get from here to there?
Honestly, what's needed is intergenerational change over, like, we have to educate children to think differently and to recognize stereotypes and to understand their emotions. And I'm not joking when I say everything has to change, right? Institutions are inherently conservative. And we live in a very traditional patriarchal, and it's a white supremacist patriarchy, which in another country, we might be referring to caste, which Isabel Wilkerson is now clearly doing in terms of writing about race in America. But there's no quick fix. There's no easy fix. I think a lot of the hard work, frankly, is the interpersonal work between men and women in their own relationships as models for children, particularly heterosexual men and women, particularly more affluent men and women, because they really have a vested interest in keeping things the way they are. And that's hard. I mean, even with this COVID, we've just seen millions of women be forced out of the workplace to take care of children. And nobody really thinks of that as a wealth transfer to men over time. Because those women can't go back into work. They can't get tenure. They can't accrue benefits for taking care of their family. I mean, they're really substantially impoverished in terms of their long-term security and professional lives by having to do that because we don't understand care as a social issue, as an infrastructure issue, as a political issue.
So then let's take it back to the personal. So what can I or any woman who's listening do around claiming and being like empowering herself or claiming her rage or really working through her anger? What are the things that, not necessarily institutionally or politically, but as a person who's really committed to my own transformation, what can I do?
Well, yeah, I think there's several things, and I try and cover this in the book, but one is to understand intersectionality, that not everyone is having the same experience, right? And so a lot of times we just kind of want to universalize things like emotions. We're all human. We all have emotions. But in fact, the point is the emotions may have a similar genesis, but their social construction means we experience things very differently. So I would say that's very important, to be sensitive to difference in a way that is productive. Secondly, maybe think about the ways yourself are minimizing your anger, using minimizing language. I'm stressed, I'm tired. You scratch the surface of any stressed woman and you're going to find rage without any doubt. There's just no doubt. You're three questions in and she's going to say, well, I'm just really angry because I don't have enough help, or I'm taken for granted, or any number of other things, right? And that's important, to be able to actually say, it's serious and I'm angry. It's not trivial and I'm not just tired. And if I'm not going to be tired, I need help, or I need this to stop. And the third thing is, which is sort of related to that, really make some meaning out of it. What are you angry about? And can you do anything about it? And are you not making demands on your family or your spouse or your parents or your siblings or your coworkers because you want to be nice? And at what cost? Are you getting sick, right? Do you have chronic fatigue? Do you have autoimmune illnesses? Are you not taking care of yourself? All of this is going on at once. And so I would say that, to be aware of the way stereotypes work in parenting and in personal relationships. Among heterosexual couples in particular, women don't like expressing anger because they're worried they're going to be punished in some way. So they express their anger as fear or sadness. And in fact, it turns out that men in heterosexual relationships interpret women's anger as selfish. They literally do not listen to what the woman's saying. They just think that's really selfish of her just because she's expressing this emotion. And so a lot of women, for example, will cry and they won't understand why they're crying, because in fact, crying confirms a feminine behavior that then confirms a masculine behavior, which is to provide and protect. So it's less threatening to a man, right? The tears like double down on the stereotypes, even though we don't want to cry, they come, right? And so being aware of how those stereotypes work, I would just add that it took me a long time to do this, and I really wish I had done it earlier. But if you can find a community of people to talk to these things about, and if you're a parent, a community of parents, because it's very hard to stand on your own, particularly in a school, and say, you know, the way you're talking to these kids is causing this problem. Like, here's a girl, she's a natural born leader, but you're policing her like she's a mean girl because you don't like these behaviors in girls. And so in fact, even though you're saying all these words about girls in leadership, you're actually undermining girls' ability to be leaders by tone policing them and punishing them for standing up for their rights or protesting dress codes or fighting for racial justice. Like, you just want leaders in a cookie cutter mode that isn't angry. You want the nice, polite leader from a girl, you know? And so there are all kinds of things we can do that we need to practice at home before we go out so that we're not caught off guard. Right? If you can have the hard conversations at home at your dinner table, then when they come up somewhere else, you've already had them. You're like, oh, I got this. Like, I understand this problem.
What would be possible in the world if every girl and woman had this as a context? What would be possible? And I'm holding the book up for those of you just listening. I'm holding the book up. Soraya and I can see each other. What would be possible if every woman and girl had this as a context?
So honestly, I think that change will only come if every boy and man had that as a context. In fact, the tendency too is to stay in this sex segregated world. And our whole world is separated by sex, everything from bathrooms to jobs to pay to education, like pick your thing, right? And part of the problem with that is that women's inequality is seen as a women's issue. And it's not a women's issue. It's a problem with men and masculinity. And so I know that men are not likely to pick up a book about women's anger. It's about emotion. It's a feminist book. That's a hard sell for men who would rather not know. Well, I mean, honestly, if you're a woman and you have this book, I'm always interested to know which women feel that they can ask their male friends or husbands or fathers or sons. This is important. Not my book, but books like this. I want you to read this. Because I think a lot of women don't even do that. I think they think, I just have to keep my own interests to myself, deal with it myself. Very interesting. The first book event I had was in my own city. And I was grateful because it was well attended. But it was super interesting to me which people came as couples and which people didn't. I was like, that's interesting. Well, it's just, I think there really are men who just don't think they have any connection to the issue of women's inequality at all. They just don't understand the ways in which the entire world is built around them to serve white men. I want to be very clear about this, because if you just look at the power structure in the country, then you understand what I mean, right? So more than 80% of Congress, more than 90% of CEOs, more than 98% of people funded in tech. I mean, there's really no doubt as to how power works. So the question is, how do you disrupt that? And I think you have to disrupt it in childhood.
Okay, I want to read this part of the book. Right at the very end, so you said the book really follows a linear path from when you're born to when you die, and you talk about your grandmother. And you said, after my grandmother died, in an effort to unlearn all of the negative lessons I'd absorbed after being a woman and having anger, I wrote down everything positive that anger can be. And I want to read this whole thing, but in the interest of time, because it's about 2 pages, but it's so brilliant. Anger is an assertion of rights and worth. It is communication, equality, and knowledge. It is intimacy, acceptance, fearlessness, embodiment, revolt, and reconciliation. Anger is memory and rage. It is rational thought and irrational pain. Anger is freedom, independence, expansiveness, and entitlement. It is justice, passion, clarity, and motivation. Anger is instrumental, thoughtful, complicated, and resolved. In anger, whether you like it or not, there is truth. And there's a couple other paragraphs, but so powerful. And as women conditioned into white patriarchal system in this country, we get to do whatever work we get to do to really experience our own anger, to give it the validity that it deserves, to not hide it and shove it away. My experience growing up as a girl watching my mom, everything was great. Like, she's always put together, very similar to yours. There were no plate throwing incidents, the expression of her anger. But what she did instead of throwing plates was drink every night. It must in some way or form come out.
That's what I believe too. I mean, I said, it's like water. It will find a way. And one of my goals in writing this was I wanted girls and women to stop hurting themselves. Like, you know, I remember one of my daughters when she was 14, she came home from school and she said, why are so many of my friends sick? You know, because in fact, so many girls have boys too. There's a lot of mental distress, but what you see in girls often is disordered eating, a whole spectrum, right? Mm-hmm. Everything from anorexia and bulimia to obesity, right? And along that whole spectrum, you see high rates of anxiety and depression and self-harm. And again, the response that we have as a society is to try and get them to change their behavior. Let's do some cognitive behavioral theory. Or maybe if the girl's really sick, we'll send her to a place where she'll get fixed, right? Or she needs more resilience. Let's amp up the resilience. There's never a place where people think, well, what's really bothering her? What is she not saying? What is she angry about? Because anger is central to all of those, the sublimated anger. And maybe we just acknowledge that she's coming to terms with her own vulnerability and inequality in a world that keeps telling her that she has power and has equality, and it's clearly not true.
Yeah, it's the inner emotion, the inner feelings. The external message is, oh, no, you're equal. No, you got power. You can do. And then
girls can do anything, except you know what they can't do? They can't even go for a walk alone at night.
Yeah. There's a part in the book where you talk about your daughter who is strong and she's courageous and she's adventurous. And she asks you to go to the corner ice cream shop. And it crumbles you to your knees because you realize in that moment, and I've had this moment, that you now have to tell your young child about what's out there in the world and how she needs to protect herself.
Right. And I was like, I don't want to do this. I don't want to say you have to accept, but also that you just have to accept it's a world where street harassment is fine and the threat of rape that underlies it is fine and the restriction of your physical freedom is fine. And it's interesting because it's almost a luxury because she was maybe, I don't know, 11. Again, if you're a Black family, 11's late. Like, you don't have the luxury of waiting for 11. I mean, my daughter's ethnically ambiguous. And in fact, I do believe that because of the way street harassment works, she too has often harassed on the street. So it wasn't misapprehension on my part. I knew exactly what was about to happen because she just looked a lot older than she was. She's very tall. And there's always a fine line. How much information is too much information? When do you scare someone? When do you alter the course of their development by saying something? Like, it's just very hard. So basically, I said, if you feel uncomfortable, if anybody approaches you, I want you to run up a stoop, knock on a door, find a mom on the street. Like, in my case, I would never in 100 years say, go find a police officer. Like, it's just like not happening.
They're definitely challenging. How would you describe anger for women as being sacred?
Well, honestly, I just had a very interesting conversation. I hadn't really thought of it, but I do think that there's a lot of self-compassion involved in acknowledging the good and the bad emotions that we have. We're really supposed this toxic positivity of being optimistic and, you know, just always looking on the bright side and gratitude. And maybe you just don't feel gratitude because you're really actually being taken advantage of, right? Maybe you don't feel gratitude because you don't have much to be grateful for when you really stop and look at it. And that's why I always say that, you know, this whole self-care industry, it's very gendered, mainly women, right? And we prefix it with self because we're caring, generally speaking, for everyone else. So you've got self-care. But you have to take care of yourself when other people, when your society isn't doing that job, right? So I'd say it's understanding your own anger is healthy and it is self-compassionate. It is a way of saying, I have the right in this world to be healthy and to ask for reciprocity in
Brilliant.
My relationships.
Beautiful. I really could. It's so powerful. It's so potent and it's so necessary. Soraya, thank you so much. If there's anything that you want to say before we wrap up, where can people find you out on social media or on your website? Or do you have anything else going on with your book tour? You're not touring anymore, but.
Yes. Well, no, first of all, I just want to say thank you so much. It was really delightful to be here and to talk to you. I really appreciate it. And people can find me on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram. I have Rage Becomes Her book Instagram, where I just try and share relevant news, whatever I happen to be seeing and interested in that day. But yes, thank you.
Thank you. I can't wait
for
many, many women to hear this conversation because this is what is needed. And I know that if I feel something, if I feel it, it's valid. If I feel it, it's sacred, even if it's not deemed, it's on that spectrum of good, bad, or right, wrong, or impolite, or uncomfortable. Great.
Yeah, that's right. Well, and I will say that I want to leave you with this idea because I think it's such an important idea. People who are more at peace, who are happier, who weather life's challenges, tend to be the people who are accepting of their own negative and positive emotions, right? Because we all have them. We all have them, and it's human, and we're vulnerable, and we have them for good reason. And so the people who are able to say those things out loud to themselves are generally healthier and happier people and more creative, actually.
Great. Thank you so much for being here, Soraya. Cannot wait for this episode to air and drop. And Rage Becomes Her, The Power of Women's Anger. Soraya Shamali, thank you again for being here.
Okay, my lovelies, thanks so much for listening today. Don't forget to subscribe, leave a rating and a review. Come find me on social or on my website, kristinlina.com. And remember, all of who you are is sacred as fuck. All the good parts and the shitty parts, all of you, the whole picture, the whole complete package is sacred. And remember, follow the good feelings, because what you seek is seeking you, and it's sacred as fuck. See you next time.